This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
Golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and we're going to discuss our favorite Enterprise Saves the Earth storylines and plots from the TV show and films.
Yeah, we may stretch it a bit, because we're not just talking about stopping a bad guy or an entity that may have found its way to Earth, but, you know, there's some other shows out there that maybe from an abstract point of view could imperil the Earth. I don't know, Zach, what do you think?
Well, that's right, Ken, because let's not forget, Captain Kirk and crew did literally save an entire universe, or two universes, really, in the alternative factor. So, but we've said our piece on that. We'll steer clear of that this week, huh?
Yes, please, please, please. I am alternative out. But it's been, boy, did that category have legs, did it not?
Yeah, man.
Anyway.
People love the alternative factor. Well, by people, I mean Brandon Shea Metella, but...
yeah, that's the guy.
So when we talk about saving the Earth, like you said, it's not necessarily in the there's the planet, here comes a big ship, here comes a big cloud, let's save it. There's many shades of saving Earth, right? And we start with the city on the edge of forever, Ken?
Yeah, why don't we? Because it's not about the destruction of the Earth, but it's about the destruction of our history, right? And life as we know it. So I think that definitely qualifies. And when we were talking about topics, Zach, and we were going back and forth, and we came up with this. This was the one that just kind of struck me right off the top. One, obviously, it's probably arguably the original series' most popular episode, considered a fan favorite because of its topic, and obviously the stakes were very, very high in this. And it wasn't your typical, using the ship, using this method, getting a leg up on a bad guy or an intruder or an invasive species. This was making probably the hardest decisions that people have to make in order to do things correctly. And it was, not to dive too deep into the episode, but going back in time so and to ensure that one person dies so that the Earth stays on its current trajectory towards positivity and utopia, and however that's defined in the terms that we have with the Federation, was definitely a very powerful saving of the Earth, quote-unquote.
Yeah, I like how you put that, the destruction of our history, which is just as destructive as destroying the Earth in the present time. And, you know, this is the third time that the original series time traveled. The Naked Time, it was kind of a throwaway, very random thing to happen at the end of a completely unrelated episode, and they go back in time 3 days, and they set course for their next mission, and they kind of go about their business. But then Tomorrow's Yesterday, they go back in time, and that's not really a destruction of our history in the same way as Sydney on the Edge of Forever. Obviously, the Enterprise goes back. They beam up Captain Christopher, and they're like, this guy's not important. We can keep him around. And they said, oh, no, his son leads the first mission to Saturn. Now, had he not gone back to Earth and led the mission to Saturn, I don't think we would have had a Nazi-controlled, Earth like we do in City of Legends
that's
Forever.
Right, that's
I think
right,
the timeline would have found a way to correct itself at some point. But at the time, that was a big deal. It's only the second time they had time traveled. But here, on the Edge of Forever, this is no doubt, there's a clear problem here that needs to be fixed, a fixed point in time. I love alternate history, right? Like, what-if stories in history. There's so much you see, even today, all the fiction. There's 11-22-63 by Stephen King, the novel, and now the TV show. There's Man in the High Castle, the novel, and now the TV show. Just, you know, going back, obviously these are older stories and older, you know, ideas going back to the 40s and the 60s for these ideas of, you know, what if JFK didn't die, or what if the Nazis won World War II, and they extrapolate from that. And here, you know, it's very simple. We don't actually see Kirk and Spock experience the alternate timeline where, you know, there is a, you know, a Nazi-controlled Earth in future. We just know that the Enterprise doesn't exist, and we can extrapolate from there. And your imagination says, well, what does that even mean? Like, does Earth, did we destroy ourselves? Did the Nazis not, are they still in control on Earth? But is it, are we very xenophobic and we didn't reach out and explore space like we've been doing? And but ultimately, you know, the greatest lesson here is, you know, Star Trek is all about, they're all about peace, and they're a humanitarian peacekeeping armada, as I always like to poke fun at you, Atkin. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, they say, you know, Edith Keeler must die because they look in, you know, they look in the tricorder, right? And Kirk is obviously, you know, he's always looking to save her, right? He's a little biased in his analysis, but that's what Spock is great. Spock is not. Spock always offers an objective opinion, and Spock starts telling Kirk about this alternate timeline where she convinced the U.S. to stay out of World War II, and he's like, "That's right, peace was the way." And Spock's like, "She was right, but at the wrong time."
Right.
And I think it's a very important message.
It is, and it was a very powerful message. And you know, it's funny because you talk about all the TV shows and what ifs and scenarios that could have changed Earth history. How many times in our own lives do we look back and say, if I went left instead of right, where would I be now? Right. So it's a common thought process, I think, and it lends well in this story, and I think it lends well to many, many other stories because I'm guessing that it's human nature. I don't dwell on things like that, but I it does pop into my head every once in a while. So I think that, you know, it's very relevant. And of course, with today's world, too, and all the conversations that are have, to, you know, out in Facebook land or whatever, people are always constantly asking, well, what if? Well, you know what? Doesn't matter. Deal with it now. But it is an interesting thing to kind of look back on. You know, as we were putting the list down, and we did reach out to the Babel Conference to let them know what we were going to be discussing, I was pretty happy because we'd love to get the listener participation, but I also like to say, okay, can we come up with a pretty decent list, and then if there's anything that could be added to it, you know, are there other things out there? And I didn't have a particular order, so if it's all right with you, Zach, I think we'll just kind of come up with the episodes that you know we were going back and forth on. We weren't doing them in order, unless you want to do it in chronological order. Maybe we can do that when we get to the movies more than the episodes, but I just want to kind of throw them out there.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the great thing about the original series. You can pretty much jump all around and doesn't affect the storyline, right? Because they're all very self-contained, except for a few exceptions. So yeah, let's jump around the timeline as we already have with City on the Edge of Forever. So the timeline's been corrected now. Now we can move forward.
That's a good metaphor. That was the first one. I don't know why that was on my head. But the next one that popped in was the Doomsday Machine, right? So obviously this weapon, this mammoth weapon, this planet-eating, killing weapon, wasn't in a direct path towards Earth that we knew at the time. But it took out a whole solar system, and there was nothing but rubble. The assumption was that it was going to be heading into even more densely populated areas of the Federation. So I extrapolated that to be Earth, to be part of that. And, you know, it is funny that the Federation, which is made up of, you know, hundreds of worlds and various levels of technology that they've gleaned from this, when Earth is threatened, it's always the biggest deal. But anyway, for Doomsday Machine, you know, the concept of it was great. Here we have the whole Cold War scenario where two warring factions created the mutually assured destruction device so no one wins, which was the big talk when Star Trek was made and through me growing up through the Cold War. That's what you heard all the time, mutual assured destruction, and this was the visual, realistic impact of what that means. So it was a metaphor for the Cold War, you know, nuclear arms race that we were having at the times, and, you know, clearly stating no one wins.
Yeah, I love in Star Trek where at the end of an episode, they can always pull out that analogy, the perfect on the nose analogy, right? Because it's like Kirk and Spock walking on the bridge, like, you know, in the 1960s when... It's like, man, Kirk, you have some great recall, man. But who am I to talk? I can recall Star Trek episodes off the top of my head as well. So, but it really was topical at the time, as you said, Ken, because that's basically like, look, you know, as technology advances, it advances. We're eventually going to destroy ourselves if we're not careful, and that's what happened to this society, right? I mean, that's a classic sci-fi idea. You create this technology to win a war or defend yourself, and then it accomplishes its mission. And then it just moves on to the next thing, either through bad programming or through who knows what the circumstances were about the Doomsday Machine, right? And I know that mm-hmm. there has been lots of books and comic books and, you know, fan theories about where it came from and what its purpose was. Everybody loves to tie the Borg into everything. So there, Peter David wrote a novel, Vendetta, about how the Doomsday Machine was actually created to defeat the Borg. But, you know, it's just a metaphor for exactly what was going on at the time. That's what Star Trek was great about. And a great episode as well, right? It has a great message, but much like Sitting on the Edge of Forever, it has a great message, but it's told so excellently. Both these episodes are on the top 10 of pretty much everybody's top 10 favorite TOS episode lists, right?
Oh, I think so. And Commodore Decker, what a great, great character. Really was. I loved everything about him. But so yeah, it was a great episode all around. Okay, so that was Doomsday Machine. Balance of Terror, we threw in there. That could be a bit of a stretch if you think about it, because there already had been a war with the Romulans, but there had not been a weapon that we had seen or that they had seen to this point that was so destructive, that energy plasma weapon that took everything out of that ship, right? And obviously, if they did not destroy that ship and the Romulans were successful in their mission, showing or demonstrating that the Federation had weakness and could not defend against them, they would have been coming through the neutral zone with their cloaking devices, with nothing but our motion sensors to track them, and potentially get all the way to Earth and blow it to smithereens. So that's why Balance of Terror we have on this list.
Yeah, Balance of Terror, it's more of a stretch, really, because...
It's a stretch.
...than these other ones, because no one set a direct course for Earth, as they will do as we move forward here, but... You know, if you extrapolate what a total war with the Romulans would be, obviously, you know, if they want to conquer our territory, Earth is this, as you were saying, for some reason, Earth really is the center of the universe. You know, everybody makes a big deal about how Galileo disproved that Earth was the center of the universe, but apparently in the Star Trek universe, Earth really is the center. So yeah, if the Romulans are going to conquer your territory, they're going to go for your capital, right? That's tactics right there. They're going to take over Earth. They're going to take over Starfleet. So down the line, that it was a very distinct possibility, and that really raised, if you look at Balance of Terror through that lens, like, man, the stakes are already high enough, and you think about that, like, whoa, the stakes are just as high as they get, you know?
Yeah, and you know, we have the ability now to move forward many years and look back through Enterprise, and we knew even during the original series that the war with the Romulans was Romulus versus Earth, right? So if there's a place they're going to come after in the Federation, it's Earth, right? So that's kind of how we draw that line, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mm-hmm. capital of Starfleet and the United Federation of Planets.
Apparently, right? And in one show that we shall not name, it's what, Sector 001. Okay, that's all we need to know. We are it. We rock. All you other planets, just follow along.
Indeed.
All right. The next one we came up with very appropriately, and I will mention that Christopher Baca, who comes up with everything too, mentioned this. But in the same way, when we were talking about this back and forth, and we were talking about, obviously, you know, the motion picture was big, but then you go, okay, well, what was that based on? It was based on Changeling, starring what we call the Happy Italian, right? He's a nomad. So
is that a I'm song? Sorry,
that was really bad. No. It's just I just remember that I had an uncle with a strange sense of humor. He was kind of a funny guy, but we'd be boating a lot, and there would be, if you had to slow down to go under a bridge or whatever, he said, he would always say, "Sleepy Italian, what's that? He's a no wake." Okay, so that's where that came from.
Gotcha.
So I'm so sorry if I've offended anybody. Deal with it. It's a sense of humor. Relax. Anyway, so The Changeling. Great concept, great episode, right?
I really like this episode. Yeah. I know that people look back on it and make the comparisons to Star Trek The Motion Picture, which we'll talk about in a minute here. I think it's a very compelling episode, especially the crux that it thinks Kirk is its creator, Jackson Roy Kirk. Like, that adds so much drama to the whole thing, and I just find it a fascinating episode. And yes, if Nomad's mission was to sterilize, it would have eventually gone back to Earth and sterilized Earth. So yeah, this is a lot more direct. Like, okay, if we don't stop this thing, because Doomsday Machine was like, yeah, it's floating around, and it'll probably end up at Earth at some point if it just keeps eating planets. But this was like the Nomad here, the Changeling, was going to go to Earth. So yes, we had to stop it. So this is definitely a no questions fits our criteria of the crew saving Earth, in my opinion, by stopping Nomad.
It's very direct. Yes. This is a threat that has to be neutralized. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. No obscurity at all. Okay. How about this one? We kind of go back to the same lines of Balance and Terror, where we had Errand of Mercy with the battle with the Klingons at Organia.
Yeah, I mean, again, extrapolating what Total War would be with the Klingon Empire, much like the Romulan Empire. If, you know, the Klingons were going to win the war, they would have, you know, taken over Earth, planted their flag at Starfleet headquarters, and that's... That's how war works, right? Again, if you extrapolate this, of course, the Organians interfered and the war didn't get very far, you know. But they had not interfered and we were at the risk of losing a war, then yes, very possible to extrapolate that in the future and we'd be all pledging allegiance to the Klingon flag in the 23rd century.
That's right. What is it from Star Trek III? The Klingon flag, the Federation flag swinging in the breeze? Yeah. Beautiful.
Exactly. I was thinking of that myself.
Yeah, just when you said that, that kind of hit there. Yeah, so I think that, yeah, okay, you know, I mean, that would be a good conversation to have. Obviously, it would be an interesting campaign to see if war was allowed, where it would end up. You know, you kind of get a feel for that in Star Trek VI a little bit, though I don't have that on our list. But at any rate, it's just one of those things where I see that war in any forum with the Federation would be a threat to any planet in the Federation. And if any ship was conquered and they got into the computer banks and everything points to 001, well, that's where you go.
Well, the thing about Earth is in Starfleet, all right, because it's aligned in the Federation, that really protects it. Like, it really, because we were talking about the Romulans, right? There was the Earth-Romulan War, right? That was between Earth and Romulus, and that's like, okay, two planets. And we can see why they kind of came to a stalemate and went about their business and established the neutral zone. And, you know, if the Klingons here, if they go to war with, you know, Earth or Starfleet or the Federation, right? The Federation has to be so much bigger than the Klingon Empire, right? Because you think just over time, they keep fighting. How much resources does the Klingon Empire really have, right? Of course, in the original series, you know, the Klingon Empire was established more as it was the USSR, right? And Starfleet and Federation was the United States, right? So it was more of an equal power, you know? It wasn't just the Klingon Empire, it's Klingons. The Klingon Empire was, you know, we're an organization that is, you know, assimilating planets, you know, and expanding its influence. So the Klingon Empire was not just Klingons versus all of the Federation planets and species. It was like, here, the Klingons have their planets and the Federation have their planets, and these two superpowers vying for control. And that's why you have episodes like Private Little War, where they're like, this is a very crucial planet to the Federation. You know, obviously the communism and, you know, the first domino to fall and all that. Again, the 60s analogies, but the sci-fi trappings of it. That makes a lot more sense. Now, when you go further in the timeline, right, it seems to me they kind of lost that angle on the Klingons, and the Klingon Empire was just the Klingons, right? There wasn't much else to it at that point. I mean, they talk about how they used to conquer planets and that thing, but, you know, looking at it through the original series lens, I think the Federation and Klingons would have been a lot more equal. And you know, hey, this is before Praxis exploded, right? So you don't really know they have plenty of resources at this point. I think it's very possible the Klingons, I mean, if they're a lot more warrior driven, right? They live for battle, they live for war, then they're a lot more motivated on several fronts to win these battles, right? And the Federation, I mean, they're out there, they're not warships, right? They're explorers. So they're not really, I mean, obviously we had a few captains who were a little more war hungry, you know, for action and battle and glory. it's hard to say. You know, that's a cool what if game we should talk about. If there was a Klingon war, what would happen, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good, because the terms are pretty equal, right? I mean, the ships are fairly well matched, and yeah, I think that would be a great conversation. We'll put that down in our show notes, you know. So Klingon versus Federation. I'm sure, you know, as a person who does not play and has played very limited amount of video games, I have to say, I'm sure that there's a lot of games out there that have been designed so that it becomes more strategic, you know, where things are pretty even, and you have to outsmart, you know, outlast, outwit, kind of like the was that the Survivor logo there? Anyway, so, you know, in order to win, and I would think that would be very similar with the Klingons because they're battle savvy, you know, and the thing is, and I think this is where Star Trek plays off well, even though it's not, you know, we kind of always refer to Earth in the past as being, you know, very violent and all these things. It is, but one of the things that, you know, that's kept tucked away in the DNA of all humans is we know how to fight. The Klingons are just reflective of, you know, like in this case, Russia, but as Star Trek evolved, so did the Klingons, and they kind of had more of you know, like a ninja approach to them or you know, that type of thing. So right. Anyway, I think it would be fun to talk about. All right. On to the next one. I like this one. Assignment Earth.
You like this one, huh?
I like this as being a topic to discuss. I mean, you know, a guy and a kitty cat from future come back and they're here to save the planet from going boom. It's it definitely fits our criteria for today's discussion.
That's true. In the context of this discussion, I like it as a choice.
That's what I meant, yes.
Yeah, so Assignment Earth, they go back in time to study the past, which was interesting. Like they didn't have an accident or fall through a black star like they did in Tomorrow's Yesterday. They're just, yes, we've gone back in time to discover how humanity to survive the late 1960s, which is just an interesting mission statement for a captain's log, right? Their temporal prime directive right there that stops you from doing this, right? But you know, sometime we need to go back. I know in Trials and Tribulations they mentioned the amount of times that Kirk violated the temporal prime directive. I want to add those up sometime, but. But that's beside the point. That's not our discussion today. So Assignment Earth, right? The whole crux of it is Gary Seven comes on and they think that the Enterprise crew thinks he's interfering with things, but in fact he's saving history, right? So it's based off these misunderstandings of what's going on, which just shows you that communication is the key, people. If you just stopped and talked about things, you would solve a lot of problems, right? Because they keep trying to, you know, interfere with each other's plans, and it almost blows up big time. But eventually they have to trust him that he's doing the right thing, and history plays out as it should, and I guess it's kind of a reveal at the end that the Enterprise was always part of this history, right? I guess that's like a, oh, yep. Wow, you know, it's not really a twist, more of a reveal.
The paradox.
Yeah, right. Predestination paradox, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think I don't know if we need to get too much further into it, because that was essentially the gist of it, uh-huh. And it was obviously to launch a new show, and so a pilot, right, or a pre-pilot, I mm-hmm. guess.
Backdoor pilot is the term they use in the industry, yes.
A backdoor pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anyway, so that would be, that would be Assignment Earth. So we'll...
that would have been cool. It's like he's like an American Doctor Who, right? I mean, he's even got the sonic screwdriver, basically. So that would have been a cool show in the 60s. It could have lasted a couple seasons, right?
I guess so. You know, I thought the cast would have been interesting, right? I mean, Terry Garr, she did pretty well. She got more and more popular in the 70s and 80s as time went on. I think she the most notable, you know, of the cast and crew. And when I do see it and I see her in that episode or whatever, I always thought she had kind of a quirky part, you know, and she was kind of cute and funny. And yeah, it was what it was, but I don't. It's hard to say. Okay, this is just a Star Trek episode. It was definitely something that they had to really work hard to manufacture the reason why they were there, and were able to introduce it. But I do like the way they intercepted him. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah,
you know.
But so. You know, but so it counts as saving Earth, even though they really didn't do anything. They just kind of observed history, right? If anything,
were part of it, though. They wound up being part of it, right? They probably, well, in many ways, they interfered with the saving of Earth.
Right, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, they saved the day despite themselves.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. That might be the one and only Star Trek episode in all of the Star Treks where the good guys almost accidentally destroyed. Right. Mm-hmm. You think about it. Huh. That would be another thing to look at, but we'd have to get our friends on the other podcast to kind of think that through.
Right. For sure.
Mm-hmm. So the next one that's on the list, I have to make a full confession here. I didn't have this one originally. It was, and it's so damn obvious. This one is the immunity syndrome. And it was one of those things not long before we were recording did that pop up with Christopher Quarry. I was like, damn, how the heck did we miss that? I mean, you know, everybody came in, whether it was Craig or Trey or John. Tim Hans had a few. I think we captured most of them in our notes before we went on, but it's always kind of fun to see where people were coming up with. But Christopher, nice save, because we would have been hitting hard. It's like, how did you idiots forget that one? Well, I'll say idiot because Zach, you're not an idiot, but
thank you, Ken. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Because I hear that two or three times a day before I leave the house. So at any rate, so nice save on the immunity syndrome. And you know what? I really, really like this episode too. I like the idea of a disease or a single cell coming in and consuming all. And it's just, it's science fiction at its best. I thought it was one of the more clever Star Trek episodes. Great bottle show, I thought.
Yeah, high concept sci-fi, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the most iconic images of the series, like if you see that giant cell and then the Enterprise in front of it, you know exactly what it's from and what episode it is. And yeah, this is one of those big picture saving the Earth, because they pretty much save existence as we know it, in our galaxy. Yeah. So the Earth kind of falls under that category. They're not, it's not like this thing showed up at Earth and we have to stop it. It's just like this thing's going to eventually, reproduce itself, right? Because it's that's how it works, and then overwrite or take over our universe. So yeah, I mean, yeah, you stop this, you save Earth. So that counts in my book.
Oh, absolutely. And it was I guess this universe, this galaxy, was serving as its primordial soup, wasn't it? It was a whole new life that was coming in to take over just as it was happening, billions of years ago on Earth.
So, and some great character moments in this episode, too, between Spock and McCoy especially.
Well, Spock's reaction when the, was it the Intrepid? I'm trying to remember.
The Vulcan ship, right.
Yeah. And it was also fascinating that the limitations of logic did not allow 430 Vulcans to figure out why this was happening.
Hmm.
Right, that in itself was quite a wild concept. So, as advanced and as dispassionate, if you are limited to a reality that you feel cannot be changed, so that concepts beyond it cannot be considered, right? So it shows, because the Vulcans, right? They're stronger, they live longer, they hear better, they have inner eyelids. There's really not much you can do to a Vulcan, right? I mean, they really don't die. They kind of, it's amazing. However, they have a huge Achilles heel. It's never really brought up again, but I thought it was, well, to put it in Spock's terms, fascinating.
Yeah, it really just goes to show you how important your worldview is, right, and how you view the world. Because if you stay in your lane, you don't think outside the box, to use a cliche metaphor, but I mean, that's what it is, right? You're not getting able to see these other possibilities. And that's, Spock is so well served as a character because he's half Vulcan and he's also half human, right? So he can balance those things out. That's why he's the best of both worlds, right? Because he can use his Vulcan intellect, but then also his human ability to reach beyond the facts, right? And that's what makes him such a valued member of the crew and such an awesome character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I think that, it is brought up again in a sense at the end of the motion picture.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, this one simple feeling.
V'ger could not evolve because of its limitations with logic, and it was interesting. All right, so before we leave the TV series, Zach, is anything we're missing? I'm going back now. I'm taking a look, and I think we've captured them all. I don't think there's anything else out there that the listeners threw out, unless I'm reading too fast. But I don't.
Yeah,
think
I mean
so.
For a show that, you know, it's more of a movie trope, really. And we'll get into it here, right? Because that's our next step. But, you know, the Enterprise is always the only ship in the quadrant, and it's always got to save Earth. It's like, well, if you look at the original series, you know, there's 80 episodes. We talked about, what, like, 6, 7? Like, maybe? Like that's less than 10% of the show is them saving Earth. And even half of those are in the grand sense of, like, we save the galaxy, we save the universe, we save the quadrant, right? And if you extrapolate this a death machine that might have come and destroyed Earth, right? But actually, like, saving the planet Earth, I mean, and some of those are history. So I think, you know, they did not go to that well too often on the original series. They were out there on the frontier, really, on the 5-year mission. Later shows, obviously, they're going back to Earth on a more regular basis, but for various reasons, right? But the original series, we never actually, you know, in the original series proper, we never got to see 23rd century Earth, which, you know, lots of reasons why, story reasons, budgetary reasons, and we never got to see it. So the Enterprise never got to go to its present day Earth and save any threats from there. They always ended up going in the past to save it. It's interesting, you know, when you really start to break down and examine these tropes, right? Because everybody has their ideas of, like, oh, yeah, Captain Kirk, he's a womanizer, he's sleeping with green women, he's doing this, he's doing that. It's like, actually, there's no episode where that happens, you know?
No, there isn't. You're absolutely right.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, he comes close, but then she's about to stab him, right?
Yeah. Well, that's how it works, Ken. So.
Yeah, so there's a warning out there. Stay away from green women. Anyway, I don't know where I'm going with this stuff. It must be early in the morning when we're recording this, huh, Zach? Only one cup of coffee and we're rocking and rolling through this bad boy. So anyway, I just a quick call out to Trey Womack, Greg Malumbi, Christopher Baca, Tim Hands, John Thomas Downing, Nicholas Anastasio, and Christopher Query, for throwing their 2 cents in, very important 2 cents. Suzanne, we're gonna come back to you, Suzanne Williamson, in a minute as we go through the rest of these films. I'm sorry, as we go through the films. So let's start off with unquestionably, undeniably, the best Star Trek movie in history, Star Trek the Motion Picture. As many people now go, what the hell is he saying? Anyway, so
I think something's gone wrong with our history, Ken.
Is that right? You know, something could have happened. All right. For at least 20 of us out there. Yeah. So Star Trek the Motion Picture. What a this was obviously the first movie, the first epic blockbuster type approach to Star Trek, and they did it big, and so they wanted a lot at stake. And just like they kind of pulled it off with the Changeling, Earth probe goes out there, gets lost in what they used to call a black hole. I don't know what they call it then, other than because I've heard them say black hole. But anyway, so it goes through what they used to call a black hole, emerges somewhere on the other side of the galaxy, machine world, rebuilds this planet, and now it's going to search for its creator, which it feels should be in its own image. And that is going right towards Earth, huge machine. And they actually do deploy weapons in orbit around the Earth that would annihilate the entire surface of the planet. So a big high-stakes game here. This is a very direct threat to Earth, and it's a mystery, right? We don't know why or who or whatever until the last 20 minutes of the movie as to what its motives are and why it's doing what it's doing. We get little hints along the way, but this was definitely a direct threat and a man-made threat, although not by design, on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the classic AI that does what you're not expecting it to do. We are the architects of our own destruction, inadvertently, but still. You mentioned the black hole, and in the Star Trek, I mean, they're using this 1960s logic, and I applaud them for sticking with it, even though, you know, scientific studies have shown that haven't proven without a doubt, because I guess we never know, but when you go in a black hole, it's nothingness. It rips you apart, right? It's not a portal to somewhere else. It's not a wormhole, right? It's not like that. There's a difference between a black hole and a wormhole, and even in Tomorrow's Yesterday, they call it a black star. So, I mean, they have that. The Enterprise, that's how the Enterprise went back in time there. In Star Trek 09, Spock and Nero go through a black hole created to stop the supernova. So my point here is that, you know, this has always been my theory. You think about how could Voyager 6, right, assimilated all this information over, what, 300 years? Like, in my opinion, I think the black hole sent it back in time like a really long time, right? That's just my fan theory about Star Trek the Motion Picture, right? It goes back in time a really long time, goes across the galaxy, and it amasses all this stuff, right? And that's how it's so massive by the time it comes back to Earth. So that's just a little fan theory from me to you guys, so let me know what you think about that. But anyway, definitely a threat to Earth. Like, this might be the biggest threat to Earth, because as you said, Ken, those devices that V'ger deploys, like, that could level the planet, right? I mean, any kind of invading fleet or whatever, like, they're going to attack Earth, and you know, we see it in Deep Space Nine when the Breen attacks San Francisco, right? You're going to attack little pockets, right? But you're going to just devastate the entire planet. I don't think any conquering force is going to do that, right? They want to take over the planet. They don't want to just annihilate it entirely. So this V'ger would have been the most destructive, we'll see. Well, when we get to Star Trek 4, I guess, but the most destructive force that the Enterprise comes across, and fortunately, they save the day, right?
Of course they do. It's Kirk. It's what they.
It's Kirk talking to a artificial intelligence. Of course he's going to win.
Of course he's going to win, and there's no doubt about it. It's just yeah. Anyway, I like your theory about the time. I would say in my head, what happens is, as you accumulate knowledge and your technology grows, the ability to solve for equations or to scan further out also exponentially increases. In over 300 years, when you're starting from a pretty high point in technology, and you're only expediting, I guess, that ability to collect data, you know, millions and millions and times faster and faster and faster, day after day after day, that theoretically you could get your arms around what's going on. I know they say the universe or the galaxy.
Spock's like, the whole galaxy is in here. It's like, really?
Yeah, yeah, whole galaxy. So, you know, maybe. But at any rate, it doesn't matter. Its concept was huge, and it's beyond, I think, us really to even imagine that. I mean, you know, the concept of even traveling to Jupiter right now is unbelievable. So yeah, it definitely was a real threat, and you know, for me, a great plot line. And I know it gets comparisons a lot to the Changeling looking for its creator and all that stuff, and it should. There's definitely some parallels there, but scale, scope, everything else about it, very different. But
and ultimately, this one made sense. A lot of times, Earth is in jeopardy, right? You're like, okay, well, that's contrived. Why would they come after Earth? We've talked about that across the franchise, really. But this one, of course, yeah, V'ger, right, is from Earth. So it's returning to its home base to meet with its creator. And that once that mystery is revealed, it all makes sense why it's headed this way. It's not just some, oh, Earth is in the way of this cloud, we got to stop it. Like, no, it's coming here with an objective, with a purpose.
Yeah, that's right, and its purpose was good. It originally, it wanted to share everything it learned, and its inability to jump beyond logic and its dispassionate, very binary thought process, you have stifled the creator, right? So, bye bye bye, you go away, and we'll find the creator. You know, pretty big leap for something as sophisticated as it was, but again, that's your worldview. That's what happened. So, all right. So, thank you, Suzanne Williamson, for the Star Trek IV poster. I think she was the first one to respond. And, you know, Star Trek IV, it was funny, before we started recording this, I was looking at some scenes from Star Trek IV on YouTube again, because it is such a great movie. And conceptually, this is probably my favorite Earth in Jeopardy concept film for all the Star Treks.
The one with the whales trademark, right?
The one with the whales.
I loved how we were talking about favorite movies, and I believe it was Suzanne who called it that. Like, it's like, hey, everybody, list your favorite Star Trek movies, and this one was the top of her list. And it said, the one with the whales trademark. I really like that, because you know when you say that, when you're in, like, the real world, so to speak, right? And you're just talking to people about Star Trek. Yeah, you know, The one with the whales. I like that one, right? That's what people refer to it as. But yeah, this is, again, man being the architect of his own destruction. More directly, right? Because he created, you know, obviously, we created the Voyager probe to go out there and assimilate all knowledge. We had no idea that it would get, you know, something, the wires would get crossed somewhere along the way, and it would come back and feel that we were the infestation. The carbon units were the problem, right? But with Star Trek IV, like, this is just, you know, greedy capitalism, man-centered, you know, whatever you want to call it, right? Whatever category you want to put that stuff in, profit was being made off of killing whales, right? So we didn't care about, like, hey, these are animals and they're part of our ecosystem and, you know, and they're intelligent. So maybe we should just slaughter them because we can make money, right? There's a thought, right? But, you know, it got out of control and the whales went extinct, you know, in the 23rd century of Star Trek. They're all gone. Guess what? Whales are here before you, and they were talking to aliens. The aliens are back. They want to talk to their friends, the whales. They're gone. We have a problem now. And it's not like the probe did not come here with malicious intent. It just wanted to, you know, hey, where are my friends, the whales? So it starts, you know, evaporating the oceans looking for the whales. You know, it's not even considering the fact that there's, like, humans and other life forms on this planet, much in the same way we, you know, walk on an ant hill, right? We're like, oh, there's ants in there, whatever. I'm looking for fill in the blank, right? So it's so far on another plane of understanding than we are. We are absolutely nothing to this probe that comes to talk to the whales. And I thought that was a very fascinating concept. As Spock says, you know, only human arrogance would assume this probe's message must be meant for man.
That's right. That's where it kicks butt. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, you say, oh, we're, you know, kind of jumping after the whales for capitalism. Well, if you think about it, the people that were really hunting whales back in the 80s were the Russians. it wasn't the capitalists because it was outlawed by the United States and most of the countries. I think Japan and Russia were the last remaining two, and I don't remember if Japan specifically was hunting humpback whales back then. But a couple of things. I think this movie, you know, sometimes I can be turned off a little bit if a movie gets too preachy. Right, this movie was not too preachy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't. It did it right. It sent the right message home, and in this case, the storyline was perfect. It was unique. We've had zillions of monster movies where, you know, radiation or whatever turns bunny rabbits into killer giants and Godzilla, you know, and in this case, it was man killing the giants, the benign giants. That caused our own destruction if it wasn't for time travel, right? I mean, it was very short-sighted thinking. And I thought it was a brilliant movie. And it's obvious, it's many times an understated or forgotten Star Trek film, even though commercially speaking, in total dollars, it was the most successful of all the movies until the Kelvin timeline films. Right, I think the motion picture might have made more money overall when you in real dollar value. Star Trek IV was the biggest commercial success they had, especially domestically, and it was just a great movie. And one of the things that was interesting too, Zach, is that there was a commercial for Pacific Life not that long ago that specifically talks to how the humpback whales have rebounded, right? And they're pretty much off the endangered species list, and you wonder, you know, sometimes we tend to give too much credit, but sometimes we don't give enough credit for things that might have jolted people's memories or got people to think a little bit more. And this movie, with its appeal at the time, anyway, might have done that. And you know, I'm not saying they're directly responsible. It's obviously There's huge organizations, Sea Shepherd, others, Greenpeace, whatnot, that have been fighting this fight for decades and decades. So I don't want to – that's what I say. You have to be careful of how much credit you give something. But I would definitely think this gave it a little bit more adrenaline and a bigger push and a larger scale, easy awareness, right? Because you've got a captured audience that's going in there to see Star Trek, not maybe a bunch of people that are thinking about saving the environment specifically – or a piece of it, but this movie made us all think. It was wonderfully, wonderfully done, and I thought the best save the Earth movie that we've seen in the Star Trek franchises.
Yeah, that's an excellent point about the pop culture awareness or societal awareness or whatever terminology you want to use talking about the whales. Because obviously, you know, endangered species. We have endangered species, you know, across the planet, unfortunately. Whales of all kinds, really. have their own targets on their back, so to speak, for various reasons. I think definitely that you can credit this movie, and that's a great point. A lot, so true that a lot of times, you know, arts and fiction and Star Trek itself, right, gets too much credit for things and social change. But in this case, I think there's a direct correlation. I mean, you look at, you know, 25, 30 years ago now, this movie's been around, and the whales have rebounded. And I think, you know, you've seen those humpback whales on posters and VHS boxes and all that. And of course, the movie being so great, all those things together really raise the cultural awareness so that you can't buy that kind of publicity, right? You can't. I mean, and you look at, you know, and I think the best art really, it's not a prerequisite for art being successful or anything, but the art I appreciate the most is stuff that causes social change like that. I mean, you look at, to a different, obviously this is a fiction film, but you look at a more recent example, the documentary Blackfish, right? It's about the killer whales and how, right, you know, SeaWorld, for, you know, example, has been, you know, pretty much taking advantage of these animals, you know, capturing them in the wild, putting them in really bad living conditions, you know, and like, I had no idea. I loved SeaWorld as a kid, going to SeaWorld. And, but now you look at that, like, oh my gosh, what have we, you know, what have we been doing to these animals that don't need to be in a, like the equivalent of a bathtub, if you extrapolate it to what a human size where they should be, as opposed to where the whale should be swimming around in the ocean there in this the limited size tank. Anyway, I saw this film and it was like, whoa, blew my mind. And now, you know, there's actually been, it's created some actual change. There's actually been legislation made. So SeaWorld has made some decisions due to the, you know, boycotts and whatnot, and have changed their approach to killer whales, and we're making progress, right? And that's all you can ask for, progress to be made. And definitely Star Trek IV had the same effect on humpback whales of all kinds. Everybody loves the whales, basically. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen posters made in jest, you know, dolphin-free tuna, you know?
Yeah.
And the tuna's like, well, what about me?
It is interesting how we're selective about that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Well, you don't taste as good, obviously. So, yeah.
But, yeah, this movie proves you do not need to go to the same villain that wants revenge trope that films, Star Trek films, but all films really often do. It's such an easy character motivation, right? But truly, man is the greatest villain, Ken.
Right, but you know what? They don't have to hit you over the head with a club, right? You can go into this movie. You have fun with this movie. Because it's, you know, again, sorry to use this term, but, you know, fish out of water story, but appropriate. I know they're mammals before I get notes. But yeah, anyway, it really is a fun film that has a great message. So you can have a good time and you can come away thinking about something that's very important. And it spawns action. But at the same, like I said, you know, you don't have to. You go into to some of those other movies, and it's just like, oh, you know, because in a lot of cases too, it isn't. I would say in the whaling industry, where most everything could have been made synthetically, even at that time, it was. There really wasn't an excuse to do what they were doing. I can't think of one anyway. There wasn't a need that I understood. Other than culturally, you know, they like the blubber, the whale meat, the whale oil and stuff that they liked, and especially cold regions of Russia, Siberia and stuff. But at any rate, it really didn't make much sense. And it's nice to see things change. And if you think about where we were in the 80s, and there's a great line where they're looking at the San Francisco Examiner or whatever it was, you know, about the nuclear arms talks stalling. And it's like, it's amazing we ever got out of that era. Well, within 3 years, 4 years, we were out of that era. Right? It's amazing how fast, you know, things can change. And both from a political one, you know, because the world then was very different now. And but even from an environmental, the focus on cleaning things up and littering. I mean, growing up in the 70s and early 80s, I mean, throwing stuff on the ground or out your car window was a way of doing business.
That's crazy to me. You know, I mean, obviously, I come from a different generation, and that just blows my mind. People just throwing trash out the window, man.
Well, think about and no one buckled a seatbelt. No one ever buckled a seatbelt. That was not, you know, that just never happened. And you see all these, you see all these endangered species coming off the list. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that we've arrived by any means, But there definitely is a change. And I think it's probably – there's certain regions of the world where that change is really, you know, getting hold. I think the U.S. is one of them. And then there's many other regions where it really isn't, you know, that the land is there. You know, we talk about the destruction of the rainforest, things along those. Even that's slowed, but it hasn't stopped. So people are focused, and change is happening, and we are, I think, quote-unquote, evolving to understanding that it's not just us on Earth. And this was really, when this came out in 1986, whether it's by design or by accident, it doesn't matter. A lot of thought change really started to occur along those timelines. And we're seeing some really positive results because of that. Have we arrived? Heck no. But are we going in a much better direction than where we were? Absolutely. And I was there, so I know. So there we go. Because I'm old.
I was not there. But I know we spent a lot of time on this particular subject here, Ken. And, we never know where these conversations are going to lead us. That's why I love having these conversations with you. And
it's fun.
Yeah, because Star Trek, you know, it can create, like, personal change, right? Because you see something that you relates to you personally in your personal life. Like, oh, yeah, you know what? That is right, right? So you have that category. Then you have your technological change because it – you know, inspires people like, you know what, I want a handheld walkie-talkie device that I can use over long distances to talk to anyone. And someone invents a cell phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you have your, I don't know what you call it, like societal change, right? And that's what this is, right? Endangered species, that kind of thing, raising awareness. So there's so many categories you can approach, right? And then, of course, you have the, like, what if I was sent back in time and fell in love with someone who had to die, right? That's your pure sci-fi, you know, mind exercise strategy that you're never – a situation you're never going to find yourself in, right? But those are like the pillars of the drama of Star Trek. And this is, the, you know, the societal, social change one that you can actually extrapolate in the real world right now, right? That's one that is not as common, and that's why it's such a big deal that this movie was in that category.
So, hey, great conversation on this one. I enjoyed this. So the last one we have – for the original cast and crew, but a rebooted cast and crew, is Star Trek, the 2009 movie reboot, where dun dun dun, we have one big, huge, badass ship called the Narada that not only does it threaten Earth, but actually is successful in destroying Vulcan in a revenge. I guess drawn. I don't even know how you'd word it, but I guess the whole movie, the whole concept of this film is one that we've seen a long time, a lot of times in movies. You know, evil bad guy wants revenge, going to take it out on everybody type thing. I would just say this: it was executed and done very, very well. I really enjoyed the movie, and I thought it was a very unique way of destroying a planet, kind of the inside out type of deal with proto matter. Yeah, I almost said proto matter. Sorry, red matter. Yeah, proto matter was what destroyed Genesis. Anyway, you see, I'm with it. I'm with it. I just went. Oh. Anyways, so yes, and once again, you know, you have a lot of tension built up into this because you can see what this thing does and that it annihilates a planet of billions and it's going to do it to Earth. Because Vulcan was obviously the number two important planet in the Federation.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's heading towards 001. And it is an intense, action-filled, very different flavor. I mean, just talking, when you jump from a movie like Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, to Star Trek 09, I mean, obviously this was an origin story that had to have an immense threat thrown in there to pull this team together. And they picked about as big a one as they could come up with. But original in terms of method, I'll put it that way.
But that shows you the many flavors of Star Trek, right? You can have in the same movie franchise, you can have a movie like Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and Star Trek 09, right? And it all fits, and there's that connective tissue that ties them all together, and that's what's great about Star Trek, and I'm glad that we can have these different approaches to it. Now, yes, the villain plot is a little cliche, right? It really gets that way, especially if you look at the greater whole of the Star Trek movies, all 13 of them now, right?
Yeah.
There's 13. kind of lose track when once they stop putting the Roman numerals after them. It's hard to keep track of how many there were. This is, as you said, a very interesting way. It's not a Death Star like a giant laser that's going to destroy the Earth. It's just a little drop of red matter, right? Laser. Ken's doing the Dr. Evil fingers here, but it's just a little drop of red matter, right? And it's going to implode your entire planet. That's a scary concept to know that, like, just a little bit of this destructive material could destroy an entire planet. And we had just seen it in Vulcan, right? Now, were they going to destroy Earth? No, of course not. In all these films and TV shows, we knew the Enterprise was going to save the day. But having just seen Vulcan get destroyed, the threat felt a lot more real this time.
You know, they pulled it off. Great Kirk Spock moments in rescuing Pike and getting into the ship and getting the jellyfish. This is such an awful name, but anyway. I guess they couldn't come up with another concept. But anyway, yeah, they did it right in this movie. I thought it was big, it was epic, it was quite the spectacle, it was creative. And in its tone, you know, it moved. It was definitely a Star Trek like we had never seen before. It changed some paradigms. You know, its pacing was through the roof, but obviously big, and I mean big, menacing threat. That was a big ship. Was it the perfect film? By no means, no, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a nice kickoff, and this is one of the benefits of doing this show, right, Zach, is, you know, we get the benefit of playing in the whole Captain Kirk playground.
Just a final thought here on 09. Do you think it reinforced a lot of these? I mean, we're talking about the cliches of Star Trek, of pop culture. I feel like this movie, and I love it as well, but I feel like the choice to have them, like, Earth is at risk and Enterprise must save Earth again in this movie might reinforce that thought that, oh, every Star Trek movie, they got to save Earth. It's the only ship. You know what I'm saying?
I do. But I think it was very deliberate, Zach. I think they wanted people to feel like we are changing the look of Star Trek, but we're not changing Star Trek that dramatically. And what I mean by that is they kind of went overboard with it, I guess, right? Because everything was you know, mega size. Mm-hmm. The ships were bigger. The cast was more action oriented, things along those lines. However, it was still espousing the Federation. It was still espousing a lot of things about Kirk. They played on the womanizer thing, maybe too much.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
You know, and him not following orders. It's like that does not define his career. A movie here and an episode there, yeah, you know, he takes a stand and changes things and he does things on his own. But he really wasn't a rogue captain. You kind of get the feel for that.
And they course corrected that definitely as the films have continued in the Coven timeline. But especially here, I do feel like they played in those cliches, as you're saying, a little too much with him. So
yeah, they did. And I think, but like I said, I think that was very deliberate to get us back into saying, yes, this is Star Trek. And they just took it, you know, they wanted everything big, better, faster, more epic, more spectacle. And they did it right. And that's thing. And to this day, you know, and we talk about all our original series episodes. We talk about our original series movies. I still have a tough time coming up with a better scene than Kirk's birth. I really do.
Same here, man. Right? I've said it many times. That very well may be my favorite scene in Star Trek.
How do you top that? I mean, you have the action, the spectacle in the background. You have the most beautiful music. It was incredible. And George Kirk's death was, admirable and sad. And what a way to kick off a movie. Right. I mean, it was an epic beginning. So. Yeah, was it perfect? By no means. Did it have me excited for a new round of more modern, aesthetic-looking Star Trek? Absolutely. Does this give people that are traditionalists absolute fits? It absolutely does. I can understand it, but you know one of the things that I really like working with you and all of our friends on the Babel Conference is. You know, what you don't see outside, what we do inside, we see on the outside all the time. I'm not wording this correctly, but, you know, you don't hear people saying you're wrong or these movies are the crap or whatever. I mean, you know, I think a lot of
movies are the crap. I love that. Yeah, and the spelled incorrectly. T-E-H.
You know what I mean, though. But they'll go, oh, you're wrong, or you're not a fan, or you're not this. And it's like, don't tell me what I am or not. I mm-hmm. respect your opinion. If you don't like it, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. We move on. I still like you. No big deal. Kind of like the visceral experiences you have. But I, for one, love Star Trek in all its incarnations. And just like the original series episodes, just like all the other series that we've had, we have some that kick ass and take names, and we have others go, yeah, that's a Star Trek. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. You know, just didn't work out the way we had hoped, and we just kind of go, yeah, they really goofed up on that. And I don't care what era or what series you like, you have winners and you have losers. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah, and you know, ultimately, part of our inspiration in this conversation was, you know, there's a trope that the Enterprise is always saving Earth, and let's examine that. Let's really look at how many times, like, let's go down the list and see how many times they really did it. Very small percentage, right? Very small yes. percentage of the original series. And, yep. you know, that just shows you there's so many stories you can tell in Star Trek. You don't always have to go save Earth, right? Even by proxy, right? And half of the ones that aren't on our list are by proxy. I mean, some other suggestions that people on the Babel Conference had is like, oh, what about Star Trek 3? And like, well, yeah, there was the Genesis device, but no one really had it. Other than, you know, Khan in Star Trek 2, and he wasn't going to go destroy Earth with it, right? So, I mean, that doesn't really, even if you extrapolate that, that doesn't really fit our criteria. And then, yes, at the end of Star Trek 6, they do save civilization as we know it, and they're not going to prosecute, as Greg Mulvey points out. But, you know, there was a conspiracy going on with the Klingons and the Federation, so would they have, was Earth truly in jeopardy then? I don't know, maybe our way of life would have been in jeopardy, but I don't know. That's a much deeper, different kind of approach to saving Earth than we're talking about in this conversation.
Yeah, I think a good parallel to that is where the U.S.-Russian relations are today. Hmm. Star Trek VI says, we want to keep things the same. We don't want to be best friends, best buddies, or move along to, you know, what eventually happened into the next generation, which is all well and good. But we haven't established that either here, right, in this timeline. So there's still, you know, the Russians every once in a while still get a little froggy, and, you know, they do things. Ukraine's a great example. What's going on? So it's I looked at Star Trek VI not so much as a threat to Earth, but a threat to the norm that we have, which is, you know, a good-sized military facing off on one another, you know, keeping, you know, because they say at the beginning of Star Trek VI, you know, what will happen with Starfleet? You know, oh, our scientific and exploration programs will still stay in play, you know. So there it is. I guess it's definitely a military organization. Anyway, did I say that out loud? I'm sorry. Because they didn't say, oh, now we can stop with our military program and really increase our exploration program. Sorry, Richard, I just had to have fun with that. But at any rate, that's kind of how I see that, so I'm aligned with you. I really don't think it's a fit for this discussion, but that's because it's just our discussion. How you want to discuss it and talk it through, if you have a difference of opinion, let's hear it, you know, write it up. I'd be very, very curious to see other points of view on this.
Absolutely, Ken. Yeah, I look forward to hearing about all the things we missed, as well as you guys' thoughts on our thoughts here. And the other thing you should write up while you're at it is an iTunes review for us on iTunes, because we have our giveaway of Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 1 on Blu-ray. It all makes sense in context, guys. Listen back a few episodes. You'll know why we're giving away Next Generation Season 1 on Blu-ray. But for anyone who leaves us an iTunes review before December 15th, you'll be entered in a contest. We'll draw your name. We will send you this Blu-ray via, you know, a nice Christmas present for anybody out there who wants to leave us a review. Please let us know what your thoughts on the show. Any star rating will do. So we look forward to you guys going to iTunes and leaving us a review there before December 15th. Well, saving the Earth isn't the only thing we've been talking about this week on Trek FM. Here's a look at some things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
The crash of the Bird of Prey into San Francisco Harbor. You know, look!
There
it's heading for the bridge!
Classic those are great shorthand scenes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't know what they're looking at or what's going on, but anyway.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
We had many Ferengi, and they were all quite different. Nog and Rom and Brunt and Quark and the Grand Nagus and Moogie. They all had very different voices, very different worldviews. They were all characters in their own right, but they all fit into that culture.
Saturday Morning Trek. When she did the psychic girl?
Yes.
Like, that one where I was just like, really, Nichelle? Yeah. Like, that is the direction that you want to go? Like,
they are putting a device in the warp control room. Oh, no.
Like, I was just, oh, man. But you could tell it was Nichelle. And I was laughing so hard at that. It was so much fun.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
If you would like to get in touch with us here at Trek.fm, you can always find us on Trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/Trek.fm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at Trek.fm, Facebook.com/Trek.fm, and The Babel Conference. Type The Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners. So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, we'd like to thank Renee Roberts, Richard Rutledge, and Aaron Harvey. Thank you so much, always, for your support for both Standard Orbit and the Trek FM network. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701. You can find Richard at rut8972. And you can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at geekfilter. So if you're looking for me on the network, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm always on there, pre-post shows, talking different subjects with all our listeners. And you can also find me on Twitter at Boston, SCPO. That means Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show from the early 2000s, and we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything, really. Love to talk to you guys on there. So thanks for listening, everyone. And join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit. Save the earth. Save the earth. Save the earth. And the solution to that pollution. Save the earth. Save.